Good afternoon. My name is Mary Stutz, and I am the CEO of the Healthcare Business Women's Association. We are a 46-year-old organization. We are in 74 countries. We have about 180 corporate partners representing over 6 million employees. And the HBA's mission is to advance women and their impact in the workforce. And we are thrilled to be presenting this session this evening or this afternoon at the Female Quotient and their amazing Equality Lounge. And can we just give a round of applause for Ms. Shelley Zales and the amazing work that she has been doing. And we are thrilled to bring the HBA and its corporate partners to you, some of its corporate partners to you today. So I want to start with introducing this amazing panel, and I'm going to start on my left. Thank you so much for joining. So again, we have our corporate partners represented here today, and they were so thrilled to be able to participate in this session and talk to you about advancing women, not only in the healthcare workforce, but overall in society and the impact that that has on society. So first we have Rehan, who is, Rehan Khan is the managing director of the India region for Merck. Welcome, Rehan. And next to Rehan, we have Pavana Avasthi. She is the general manager of India's Syneos Health Organization. And next to her is Takako Oyabu. I got it right? Okay, thank you. And she is the chief corporate affairs officer at Takeda. Coming from Tokyo. We're so thrilled everyone has come in for this. And then next to her, we have Dr. Manakshi Nevatia. Yes, and she is the country president of Pfizer India. And then not last but not least is Kristen von Sagern, and she is the senior vice president of Vice President of Strategic Programs and Supply Chain and Operations at Johnson & Johnson. So welcome to our panel. As you already heard, it is going to take, the latest information from the World Economic Forum is that it'll take 131 years, some of them say 141 years, to achieve gender equity and gender parity in the workforce. And as you can probably imagine, everyone in this room is saying, no, not on our watch. We want to accelerate that. We want to move it forward. And that's what this conversation is about. So what I want to do is start with the panelists telling us about some of the initiatives that are happening in their corporations that are designed to advance women, to advance gender equity, and then we're going to get a little bit deeper into why that's so important and what needs to happen to accelerate. So why don't we start with you, Kristen? Tell us about some of the things that J&J is doing to advance gender parity.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much, Mary, for inviting me to join the panel today. And at Johnson & Johnson, gender parity is very, very important. And there are a number of initiatives that we have at J&J that really allow us to live into the gender equality, the gender parity initiatives, and give women the skills they need throughout their careers to continue to advance. One of those key programs is the Women in STEM 2D program, standing for science, technology, engineering, math, manufacturing, and design. And the program focuses not only on professional women, but also on youth and university students, really looking for ways that we can help females, young girls, young adults, and then women that are in their careers continue to choose STEM2D and stay in STEM2D careers throughout their journeys.
Thank you. How about you, Manish?
Firstly, thank you so much, Mary, for having us here. And for us as Pfizer, this is a topic very, very important to us. You know, as we've discussed in our leadership team, we use the word gender parity as a way to define really diversity, because we believe it's not just about having the right gender balance in the organization, but they need to be parity at all levels, whether we talk about leadership, whether we talk about managers, whether we talk about pay parity, in every which way. So that's something very close to our heart. And there's a lot of things we do, but maybe if I were to just summarize, I think we look at it in three ways. The first is, what can we do to ensure that our policies are really driving this home with all our employees? This is not optional. This is mandatory, and over time, we are hoping to make that journey towards really truly being parity at every level in the organization. The second is, we also take the concept of health very holistically, and so it starts at home in the sense it starts with making sure that everything we can do for women's health within the organization, we're also doing. So we launched an initiative specifically in India called ABHA, which is really to kind of create awareness and create solutions and create, you know, zones for conversation so that our women can feel like their health is as important as anything else. And last but not least, just one very interesting example that I learned in our visit to the manufacturing locations is also really tackling the parity issue at the grassroots level. So we have a very big manufacturing facility in a city called Visakhapatnam. And what they decided is to actually go into the villages nearby, identify women or students actually who are really potentially not just the degree but have the skills to move forward, brought them to the city, enrolled them in colleges, gave them accommodation, and also gave them kind of one shift working. And they bring the parents to come and meet the children, because we do believe the balance or the disbalance starts at home. So the more we can tackle the issue at home, the better we will over time ensure parity within Pfizer. So a lot of different programs, but I just thought I'd highlight the more the holistic nature of what we're trying to do.
That's great. Thank you for sharing what Pfizer is doing. And this is, I hope folks are taking notes, because these are some great ideas that can apply across industries as they are really taking seriously the advancement and the impact of women. Takeda.
Thank you. No, lovely to be here. So I want to offer one action that we call a diverse slate. And I want to ask the audience, how many of you work for an organization that has gender parity at the executive committee level? Can I see a raise of hands? Oh, this is lovely. Wow. This is fantastic, because literally last week on September 1st, Takeda, so we are one of the oldest pharmaceutical companies, but in our 242-year-old history, when I take away the CEO, we have achieved gender parity at the executive committee level. When I look at the layer below that, that feeds into the executive committee level, we're at 45% women, 55% men, and this didn't happen overnight. So what we did as an organization is a commitment to what we call a diverse slate. So whenever there's a new opening at the senior executive level, or there is, you know, a new role that's created, we made it mandatory that we need to, you know, both look at a qualified female candidate and a qualified male candidate. And it's fascinating, because 9 years ago, there was zero female executive committee members. In these, you know, 9 years, we've come so far. Last year, thank you. And last year, the women who kind of feed into the senior executive level, it was 40%. So within a year, we've increased it by 5%. So this is why the seemingly, you know, small step does make a difference. So if you haven't done it in your, you know, organizations, please consider it. And I think we can make some huge progress.
Excellent. And we'll talk about, again, why this is so important when we give you a breakdown of the healthcare workforce. But we're going to go ahead and hear from Syneos Health. Thank you, Pavna.
Thanks, Mary. Wonderful to be here, and wonderful to have the opportunity to interact with such a great audience and a panel. So from Syneos Health, the very fact that we've been collaborating with HPA since, I think, 2001 is a testimony that this was an important aspect for the organization. We didn't have to see that improve I would say at this point of time, our numbers talk for themselves. 60 to 70% of our workforce, if we look at different countries, is women. Our CEO is a woman. And four out of seven general managers who've recently been inducted into the company within Asia-Pac are women. So we've got numbers. We've got women in the board of directors of the company. So, in fact, one of my male colleagues was joking with me. He said, I need help. It seems like, you know, I'm surrounded by women all the time. But that was a joke. But yes, we do look at gender parity very, very seriously. And within the workforce, you know, apart from the policies, we need to live it. So we've got employee resource groups, and our women's employee resource group is one of the most active of all the eight ERGs that we run. And we talk about awareness on healthcare. We talk about awareness on issues. In fact, we're talking about having a policy on menopause, because we've got women of all ages, and we've got allies, we've got men working in the organization. Apart from talking about pregnancy and younger age problems, menopause is a problem we need to all know ourselves.
Thank you. All right, Rehan, Merck.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for inviting me. In Merck, 44% globally of all managers are women. And here locally in India, nearly 50% of our leadership team is women. So we're heading in the right direction. We have, similar to you, we have a women's network group with about 10,000 women globally. Here in India, it's about 300 people. In fact, Monisha Sharma, who leads it for our business, is just here. And I just want to share with you two initiatives that we're running in India. Through our women's network, which is quite differentiated and quite interesting. One is around STEM, which is around recruiting women from STEM colleges called Women in Sales and bringing them into the commercial organization. So this is working with a number of universities around the country. And the second one is an externship where we take women from our commercial organization and place them as interns in startups. So we're placing four or five women. We're doing some more, I think, in quarter four. And these women from our team go out and work pretty much full-time in these startups for 3 months. Now, the question is, well, what does it do? And what does it do for our business? So a couple of things. One, what it does for the employees is it begins to change our culture. Quicker decision-making, learning about data, learning about different ways of acting and behaving in startups, which is much more flat culture. And the second piece it does, it also makes Merck an attractive place to work. So just a couple of things, I think, where we are doing things locally as well as globally to make Merck an equitable place to work for women. Thank you.
All right. Now, the reason what you just heard is so important is because 70% of the healthcare workforce is female in the U.S. Globally, 62% of the healthcare workforce is female. When you look at public health, almost 80% of the public health workers are women. And here's the thing, those women are leaving the workforce in droves for a lot of reasons. As you may know, for the first time in the history of work, we have five generations in the workforce. That has never happened before. We have the pre-baby boomers, we have the baby boomers. Those folks are not retiring at the rate expected, not necessarily because of money, but because they're healthy and they're living longer and they want to keep contributing and be a part of adding value. And certainly in the healthcare workforce, that's critical because of the highly skilled level of workers we need to deliver healthcare. And then, of course, we have Gen XYZ. So five generations, but they are leaving. Yes, COVID played a part in it. But there are a lot of other reasons why they are leaving. And the thing that's so important about that is that we do not have the pipeline to replace those women, highly skilled women, who are leaving the healthcare workforce. So one of the things has to do with policies. Certain policies that are in place are not in place, usually, that is causing these women to leave the workforce. So we want to talk a little bit about that. And I'm going to ask Takako to start with talking about some of the policies and invite the rest of the panel to jump in if there are policies that are working or policies that are needed that's going to help women stay in the workforce.
No, thank you, Mary. And I think you asked me because government affairs is part of my remit. I think the partnership with, you know, policymakers is paramount. It's because there's certain things we can do on the corporate side, but the reality is there's societal norms that is beyond us that, you know, these policymakers need to help reshape. They need to put in the right policies, the right incentives to make sure that we can achieve gender parity. And, you know, Mary, it's interesting because in Japan, where I'm headquartered, we actually see more women in the workforce. There's more, you know, working mothers as well. The challenge is the societal expectations towards working mothers has not changed. We are expected to do everything with no help. That's Japan. But the funny thing is when I, you know, exchange my notes with my Australian colleague, he's like, Takako, that isn't just Japan. Australia is the same. There are assumptions that women have to raise their kids with minimal help. When I exchange my notes with my Indian colleagues, they will tell me, to be successful in your career and work, you need your mother-in-law behind you. And I need you guys to keep me honest here, but you know, part of my family is Indian, and I think I can attest to that. So these societal expectations, like the common thread, and the list goes on, right? The common thread is that, you know, societal expectations towards gender has not kept up with how we are today. And we do need policymakers to really start putting in the right policies and incentives. Like in Japan, if policymakers were to open up more visas to helpers so women can actually get help, if the government could advocate that it's okay to ask for help, it would make a huge difference. And I'm sure, you know, maybe my Indian colleagues and Kirsten from the US could add on some of the thoughts that you have.
Yeah. I will just say, in the research that I did for my book, The Missing Mentor, Women Advising Women on Power, Progress, and Priorities, the research showed that about 90% of male VPs and above have spouses that stay at home, whereas 88% of women at the VP level and above had spouses who worked. So what that meant is no matter how high up a woman goes in her career, she is still expected to take care of the kids, do the birthday party, clean the house, do the laundry. So the societal norms, I think, are very huge, and having policies to help address that is very critical. But you were going to say something.
I absolutely couldn't agree more with you on policies for countries like Japan and Australia. In India, and we know that, you know, just the fact that help is available and is affordable, that's very important, because you're not spending 75% of your salary to get help for your household chores. So that helps. And I think that's one of the very important things that has helped women come up in India. But during the COVID phase, when we saw everyone, you know, was stuck at home because without help, because, you know, there was nobody who was allowed to go back and forth. That is the time when we thought as a company, you know, we saw this across the globe. Women needed that help to stay within their organization and to stay working. So as an organization, Seniors Health offered, you know, either flexible salaries for flexible timings. If someone wanted 6 months of working 20 hours instead of 40 hours because they had to take care of their kids or anyone for that matter, they were allowed to do that, knowing that it is a difficult situation to deal with. And our numbers again say it all for India. We did not see attrition during that time because we allowed flexible working hours. And that's, I think that's also something with healthcare industry that's unique to the industry, that if you have workforce who is able to work across the globe and across all time zones, you can actually get the work done faster, quicker, more efficiently, and probably more cost effectively.
Yeah.
So utilize that and ensure that your workforce is there, is happy, is working, and has the flexibility of working.
And a big part of that is making sure that the same policies are consistent globally in all of the countries, because that's what I've heard since becoming the CEO of the HBA, is that there are some countries that have policies like on maternity leave, being able to take it and come back at the same level that you left. It may not be the same job, but it's the same level. But in some countries, that is not the case. You come back and take whatever job is there, and in essence, it results in a demotion for a lot of women. So companies having that responsibility and accountability to make sure of equitable practices across the countries is really critical. Go ahead.
I'll just add another dimension to gender parity is also making sure the men realize the policies we have for women. And in that vein, we as Pfizer introduced the paternal leave policy post having a children for about 12 weeks. And we don't have a lot of uptake, but we are beginning to see people take it up. And we think that's equally important because it sends a very important message that as a new parent, the role that you have as well. So in a way, yes, it's about what we do for our women, but also the message we're sending.
Yes.
And in one of the conversations yesterday, what I learned from Shelley is that apparently, I don't remember the name of the company, but there's a company where the CEO actually calls new fathers to say, why have you not taken the paternal leave? And I thought, okay, this is not to myself. You know, at some point, we really need to walk the talk.
Yes.
And I think that's it. So we have the policy now, but I think now we have to take it to the next level and genuinely encourage people, because that will take away the stigma, that will take away the perception about what maternity leave really is, but also it will drive home the message that we expect that new dads will play as much of a role as new moms.
That's gender equity too, right? Maternity leave and paternity leave. Daddy, you get to help take care of the baby too. All right, I love that. And I'm happy that that's one of the policies that is spreading quite widely. So financial stability is also a key issue for many women. And one of the things that we've talked about is this whole concept. Yes, Shelley, you can say whatever you want. Come on, take the mic. Parental leave, yes.
It's just a new inclusive term.
Yes.
So we're not putting any gender to it.
Yes.
FYI.
Yes. Parental leave, yes. Thank you, Shelley. So financial stability is also key to women's health, and it's a key indicator of gender equality. And one of the things that we're finding is this whole concept of the paper ceiling. And so that's about having to have a degree in order to get a job that pays a good livable wage, a family sustaining wage. And so there are efforts now to focus on bypassing that paper ceiling for women. It's also an issue for people of color globally. And there are some initiatives that are happening on the healthcare front to address that. And I know that the whole concept of addressing that is something that the female quotient is looking to do with the first ladies of the G20, and you'll hear more about that. But there is an initiative that I know the former CEO of Merck initiated called the 110 Project, where his goal was to have 1 million underrepresented folks in the workforce in 10 years. And the way that initiative works is he asked CEOs of major Fortune 500 companies to sign a pledge to evaluate their job descriptions to see if those jobs really required a college degree. And so many of them have signed that. Most of the CEOs here have signed that pledge. And what they've asked them to do is, once you find that there are jobs that don't require a degree, to go through a recertification process, which just means rewrite the job description and remove the requirement for a degree and replace it with the skills needed for the job, skills-based work. And Jenny Rometty at IBM actually was the first CEO to complete the process, and she found that 25% of the jobs at IBM did not require a college degree. And so they are doing that recertification process. So I want you to talk a little bit about that in general, Rehan, but I know there are other initiatives that are happening that are getting folks prepared that the industry is doing, and I have a couple of examples too.
Thank you, Mary. So in I think today, if I look at our country, and especially for our business, where, let me throw some numbers at you. 50 million employees in India, in the pharma industry, 10% are women, less than half of that are in marketing and sales, and probably a share of that are just in sales. So when we look at largest part of, you know, our population, our employees, that's mostly sales. And if I look at the skill set that are required to sell, mostly those are around, you know, good quality communication, sometimes even good quality English or the local language that you're using, and just a persistence and a confidence to go out and sell. You don't need a science degree to really go out and sell. Most people in our country, other parts of Southeast Asia, doctors are not learning science from us. They are just, you know, we obviously are communicating a message, and that can be done often without a science degree, and sometimes even without a proper degree. So while we haven't implemented that in Merck locally, certainly that's something that I think all of us should look at, because there is, at least I know in the pharma industry, a strong bias for science. And while that's important in scientific functions, in sales and marketing, that is stuff that can be taught. And I think we should look at our job descriptions and we should do it differently. I just make one more point, which is, in a previous life, another company, we actually implemented that. We took 25% of our sales force and we said we will remove that they will work, they will have a science degree, or even sometimes a basic degree. But that required a much more ambitious training program, 3 or 4 week training program when we recruited those folks. Now, when we looked at the performance of those folks versus the performance of our degreed or science degreed individuals, there was no difference. So I think I absolutely agree with you. I think if it's done in an intentional way, and you know the selection is and the training is robust, then I think certainly we can open up the door to many more folks who are deserving. Thank you.
Yeah, and there's an apprenticeship program that goes with 110, so folks are identified and they go through the apprenticeship program, and then once they finish that, they get hired in a job that pays them a great wage. We were one of the first organizations that did this when I worked for Bayer, their biotech facility in Berkeley, California, and we did the BBEI, Berkeley Biotech Education Program. We started with high school kids. That's the other piece, is that when you talk about filling that pipeline, we've got to start earlier. You can't wait till folks are in college to start, and we already know everybody's not going to college. So starting with high school and helping with apprenticeship programs and training programs. We started with having them come after school working, because the main reason people drop out of school, you know, is because they need money. That's why kids drop out. It's not because they want to be vagrants. A lot of times they're going to work. So we started with giving them part-time jobs after school when they graduated from high school. So that was the carrot, to stay in school and graduate. And then they had to do a one-year certification program. They were getting paid while they did that. And when they finished, they were hired in our manufacturing as biotech technicians, making a livable wage. And it was interesting that a lot of those kids eventually went on and got the degree to do more from a scientific perspective, because they realized, I can do it. So programs like that across the industry, and we already know in the tech space, there are certification programs, all the Cisco certifications. You don't have to have a degree. You just have to have the certification, and you get a job making amazing wages. Unfortunately, most of those opportunities are going to men. We need to educate women that they can get those certifications too. Shelley.
I just want to say one thing, and I'm not trying to be pushy or bossy, but I'll just say it. We know for a fact, if 5 companies, 7 weeks to 7 months certification, tech skills, did an HBA trial, decided to close the skill gap with women in underserved parts of the world, we know with no education, hands down, you could close the skill gap without any education whatsoever. We have the data already. You could easily give women jobs, entry level, and we have the program, we have all that. Mary calls it apprenticeship. We could call it whatever we want. We could do a trial, 7 weeks or 7 months, easiest system in the universe. It is so simple. If we just raised our hand to try, it would be a prototype with 10 more companies would follow you in 1 second flat, game over. You would be role models for change. It's like so easy. Like sign them up tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's how easy it is. Like it's a no-brainer, and we actually have the data to prove it. Like that's how easy these certifications are. And if companies would just offer it to women and guarantee the job once women are certified, it would be a game changer.
That's the problem
is we're just not guaranteeing the jobs. So then the men get certified, the men get the jobs.
Mm-hmm. And that's an excellent
It's the guarantee.
Point.
That's the piece that we found is missing, right. Is guaranteeing the job to the women once they're certified.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just wanted to put that out
and
there.
And so this is what happens when you say yes to the HBA and the female quotient, is your company gets signed up to do a pilot. So
exactly.
That's our surprise thing. But we are going to follow up on that because I think how quickly all of these companies said yes to participating in this very meaningful discussion about gender parity and gender equity, I have no doubt that they will hear us out on doing a pilot of some sort. So we will follow up and give you more information. Before we are totally out of time, I want to just touch on the importance of women's health. So we know that financial status is the number one indicator of health equity. That's another reason why this is so important. The diseases, the death rate of women who are poor economically, don't have that economic stability, the data is there. And so all of these companies have amazing women's health programs. You heard a little bit about menopause. Why is that important? Because we have 5 generations in the workforce. Okay,
exactly.
So the women who are still working, these are issues just like maternity leave. There needs to be policies around that. There needs to be policies around menopause. There needs to be the ongoing focus on women's health. We know that women are not being included in research the way that they should for things that are not related to women, like diabetes and cardiovascular disease, all these things that women are dying of, as well as men. So whoever wants to go first, Kristen, do you want to start talking about your women's health program? And we'll give everybody a quick chance, and then we'll leave.
Yes, indeed. And I actually wanted to share an example of our global public health organization at Johnson & Johnson, where we are focused on maternal health. So helping women as they're going through through their pregnancies and their postnatal care and so forth. We have a very large program focused in areas of need, one of them being Sub-Saharan Africa. So from a global public health perspective, Johnson & Johnson is heavily involved, really doing our best to support women's health and give opportunities for those that have financial challenges as well and may not have access to the healthcare readily that many of us have. So it's a really great program.
I spoke a bit about the program, Abha, but one thing I just feel extremely proud of is that we as Pfizer, in partnership with the Gates Foundation, we are just now going into a very big campaign for a donation of oral contraception. And when we actually get to the bottom of it, you know, to have our women, it's starting in 2 states at this point, but we do believe giving women the right or the power to contraceptives is going to be such an important game changer in terms of driving that message of choice and control. So that's, I mean, beyond just what we're doing inside Pfizer, but also really taking this to that next level for the country as a whole.
Excellent.
I want to say for the healthcare sector, we do see burnout of women. So one of the things at Takeda that we do, or we're trying, is really to bring mental health and well-being as a topic that people can talk about and ask for help, and you know, offer some applications like Calm or Thrive to for employees to kind of figure out what's right for them. So if we could have that conversation more broadly, I think it would help.
Yes, absolutely.
So I agree totally about the mental health. And one of the programs that we run within the organization is the employee assistance program, which means there is a site that anyone, and this is across all genders for all employees and their families, if there is an issue that they want to discuss, they can get on and get a free consultation. And they can continue that consultation, which is a psychologist consult or other aspects of health that they would like to know. Apart from, you know, the other policies on insurance, et cetera, I would like to touch upon the participation of women in clinical trials. And we know that there is a, you know, ahead of the mandate by the FDA to include diverse populations, including diverse genders, in clinical trials, Seniors Health actually formulated a DE&I council. So we've got three parts of this. One of this is an external council with external agencies and specialists who would drive, who would explain, and who would let us know how work can go on and, you know, advise our senior leadership. The other aspect of it is what we call DE&I strategy collab. So this is a group of individuals within the organization who talk across the organization and help people deal with the DE&I aspect in their clinical trials.
Yeah.
And the third, of course, is the DE&I Council, which is a group of individuals who are involved in that, and they work for the DE&I aspect. So at all three levels of the organization and beyond, we've got this already prepared, and this was ahead of the FDA mandate.
Right.
So I'm very proudly, you know, proclaiming that we've done something for the clinical trial fraternity as well.
Excellent. One last thing I want to touch on that, Rehan, I want to talk about with you has to do with the whole idea of entrepreneurship. So we know that the majority of startup companies that are focusing on health equity, and most of that is these are digital companies, new types of platforms to advance health equity, are all being started by women. Research is showing that. But women only get about 3% of investment dollars. Women of color get less than 1% of investment dollars. So this is another huge opportunity to have women business owners, business founders be funded is a huge opportunity to advance gender parity. And I know you have some experience in that in the investment world before your role at Merck. But talk to us about that.
So Mary, a couple of things. One, I think in India, you see a positive difference versus perhaps many other places in the world. I think most of our audience is aware we are the third largest health tech market in the world, one of the largest markets in the world now for funding of health startups. One of the things you find in our market is that number is probably 30% or 20%. I know, you know, in my previous life, I was involved with probably about 15 investments. Five of those were either women-led founders or women in this, you know, in the initial founding team, and being a crucial part of the setup. But having said that, I think there are a number of things we can do on the investment side, even on the corporate side, to make sure many more women are included. And initially, that piece starts up even at the college or university level around education and talking to women students, medical students, et cetera, about the opportunities that exist. Because often the message that goes out at home for most women students is a contrary one. Don't go out, take a safer job, don't do a startup, etc. What will happen, etc. So it starts there, but then all around the work that we do with startups initially when ideas are formed, and also recruiting many more women on the investing side. So if I look at venture capital funds in this country or outside, most of the partners are not women today. And I think that on the investing side, opening that up is as important as it is on the corporate side. So if anybody's interested, it's a topic of passion for me. Happy to talk to you afterwards.
And then Takako, I know that at Takeda, you all have, as a company, invested in funds, which I think is a huge opportunity for all companies, and we're seeing that with partnerships and things, but talk about your experience with that.
Sure, no, I fully agree with Rehan. I think in hindsight, so we invested in a fund. One of the things I should have thought about is every time they make an investment decision, they need to consider the diverse slate, right? There's a fund mandate, but make sure there's a female founder versus a male founder, and let's, you know, see it equally. If that doesn't work out somehow, then at least for one investment, could the fund manager, you know, either mentor or sponsor two other, whether it's a female-founded startup or a, you know, minority-founded startup, because then that gives access to the startup founders that they really need, is probably kind of in reflection what I should have done, and next time I would do. Also, to Rehan's point, you know, we do need to increase the number of women who are in making investment decisions, as well as the founder community. A close friend of mine, so she's a female in one of the biggest VCs around the world, but since she took over 4 years ago, now her investment manager is 50-50 gender parity. The folks that are in the operations, majority women. You know, when she looks at the portfolio companies, 21% are female founders. So when we have the right women in the right positions, I think it's very clear that, you know, there's great outcomes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I guess, Mary, it's what we have done, but here it's what we will do. So in the spirit of pledging, we as Pfizer have a corporate social responsibility called Pfizer Innovation, where we invest in startups. And having said that, we pick the best ideas. But one thing I do pledge to take forward is to make the gender parity topic come up as a criteria when we make those investment decisions.
Yes.
Because we've invested in very good startups, but we've not taken this into consideration. And I pledge to do that. You can hold me to it.
Excellent. Kristen, did you have one last thing?
Yes. So one additional point, just to build on the topics that have been discussed, is that we at Johnson & Johnson set metrics on female-owned businesses. So any suppliers, we have a certain percentage that must come from suppliers that are female-owned businesses. And by having that metric, it also helps drive support of female businesses. So setting those metrics, very important.
Excellent. So I know we are out of time, I believe. And so I want to thank our panel. You've heard some great ideas for how we can advance gender parity, gender equity, health equity, financial status of women. And you heard some great commitments here. So I hope you are taking note, and we'll be around the rest of the day. So if you have questions or want to talk to anybody on the panel, please join us. Thank you so much.